Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This Friday, December 7, 1941, Japanese planes attacked Pearl Harbor and the United States entered World War II. Milwaukee Public Television took 19 vets who were in Pearl Harbor in June of 2012, or they were there in 1941, and they returned in June of 2012. A documentary was made to capture the memories and the experiences of these 19 veterans from the state of Wisconsin. They traveled with Guardians as part of the Old Glory Honor Flight. And the documentary has been produced. It is going to be airing this week. There's a free preview and discussion open to the public tomorrow night, which should be a wonderful evening at the Discovery World Theater. And then this will be shown on Milwaukee Public Television. We'll give you the dates as we carry on with this hour. This is a terrific program. These stories are extremely moving. This war was an important war in our historical memory, and it is so worthwhile to hear these veterans talk about their experiences. We have one of the vets joining us in our studio today who is featured in the film, Ken Sweet. Ken was just a very, very young lad. I believe he was 18 or 19 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. He was finishing an overnight guard duty shift at Wheeler Field, and he participated in this journey back to Pearl Harbor. Mr. Sweet, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you here. Mark Segrist, a longtime friend, longtime Milwaukee journalist, is the host, the editor, the writer of this documentary, which will air later this week. Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to see you, and you still look 16 years old.
Yeah, right.
I'd like to see your driver's license before you interview me, please.
16 years old.
And you too, Mr. Sweet. You look 16, for crying out loud. We had to put our track shoes on to follow you folks at Pearl Harbor. You set quite a pace for all of us.
And yeah. Mr. Sweet's picture, for those of you who have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, is on the local section. It's a gorgeous picture of him, so you should all look at that. Tell me about the whole experience of going there. Why is this deemed such an important project? Why did you do this? This was a difficult journey for a lot of people to make. It's a long ways to Hawaii. If you're in your 90s, it's a hard journey.
Well, senior producer for the project and my good friend and colleague Everett Marshburn had this vision, and being the great producer he is, when he heard that Old Glory Honor Flight was taking a group of 19 Wisconsin Pearl Harbor survivors back to the island, he jumped on it. And he approached several of us at MPTV, freelancers and full-timers alike, to see if we'd like to join him on the project. You know, when it came to us and said, hey, we've got 19 survivors who are going over there. We have a chance to draw some wonderful stories from them. Do you want to be part of this? And only a fool would have said no. So Chris Mikulski, Dwayne Rodriguez, myself, and Everett all went over there and joined these marvelous men, Mr. Sweet among them. And we chronicled their return to Pearl Harbor. And in the course of retracing their footsteps, they shared their memories, the horrific experiences that they viewed firsthand. Mm-hmm. I don't say this word loosely, the heroic means that they took in order to assist others around them and to preserve their own lives so that they could defend the harbor. We were able to capture and share with our viewers. And it was just, sir, it's an honor to be in the same studio with you, knowing what you went through. And I'd love to have him share with you what he did there.
You're right.
At Wheeler Field, because it was nothing short of courageous and extraordinary.
Thank you.
Well, and you were just a kid. How old were you on December 7th of 1941, Mr. Sweet?
I was 19. Mm. I turned 19 in September. I got out of school in June of 40. There was a depression on, and I went down to enlist. My father had told me about the trenches in World War I, and I wanted nothing to do with that, and I've always had glasses, war glasses, so I thought I'd get in the anti-aircraft. Got down to the recruiting, and they said, Air Corps Hawaii, if you don't want to go to Hawaii, go home. Where do I sign? And, of course, in my mind was hula skirts and grass shacks, and the biggest disappointment was tall buildings and trackless trolleys.
And on December 7th, 1941, what were you doing?
Well, I was on guard duty. About a month before, we started, our airplanes were parked in rows of six. And then on Friday afternoon, we would take the rows of six and tail them together and have rows of 12 airplanes. And we had open ramp space that we had calisthenics on Saturday morning. Then we, when that was over with, everyone just took off for the weekend. We'd come back on Monday and separate the airplanes into rows of six again for normal flying, and go back to our normal routine. And when the Japanese attacked, that's the way they found rows of 12 airplanes. I was on guard duty, and two or three months prior to that, the Navy would, pilots would come up and buzz up and down our runways in the streets of our Wheeler Field, where I was. Mm-hmm. Wednesday afternoon, some of our pilots, and I don't know from which unit, would go down and do the same thing at Pearl Harbor on Ford Island. And that morning, we saw the Japanese flying along the mountain range, headed, the torpedo bombers headed towards Pearl. And we thought it was the Marines coming in from early morning gunnery. And they were far enough away we could not identify what they were, and then all of a sudden a string of airplanes came from the west, went into a circle, and we thought we were, a fellow that was with me on guard duty, we thought we were going to have the best seat for the air show that day. And then one rolled over and down he came, and we watched him come, and all of a sudden these two bombs swung away from the bottom of the airplane. And I witnessed the first two bombs striking American soil starting World War II.
And it came as a complete shock, of course, to you.
Complete shock. We were 2,400 miles from the USA, the safest place in the world.
Right.
And when we went on guard duty, we'd go to supply and draw out a rifle. And then we would draw five rounds of ammunition out of a cigar box, put them into a clip, and put them into the gun. When we came off of guard duty, we threw the ammunition back into that cigar box and turned the rifle back in. And that's how prepared we were at that time of the years. Mm-hmm. After that, after the bombing went away, the bombers, I should say, we started separating airplanes. Some of them were burning, some were not, so we're trying to separate them to save those that were not on fire. Then the Japanese came back strafing the second time, strafing up and down the parking ramps. Everyone vacated the ramp and got up under buildings and into buildings. They were no longer bombing, but they were strafing. And then when that was over with, that lasted about 20 minutes. And then we went back to trying to recover the airplanes and go try to get back to normal life.
Yeah, and it was anything but normal life. At what point were you able to make contact? Your family must have been frantic back here in Milwaukee. At what point were you able to contact them, and how did you do so to say that you had survived?
About a week after Pearl, about the 13th or 14th, the Toll Pineapple Company had a telegraph station next to the little city of Waiheawa. And another friend and I went up and paid $10 to send a telegram home that got to my parents on Christmas Day.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's going to make me cry. On Christmas Day. Oh.
Yeah.
And then it was full force. How long did you remain in Pearl Harbor? What happened after December 7th?
I was in the 78th Fighter Squadron. And we stayed in Hawaii. We were training pilots that were coming from the United States into combat tactics, and then they'd go on further into the Pacific. We stayed in Hawaii until January of 1945, when we loaded 85 P-51s on a converted carrier and traveled to Guam. Oh. We unloaded the aircraft in Guam and then flew up to Saipan, which was another island, and we sat there 3 days waiting for the Marines to establish or control the airfield number one on Iwo Jima. Mm. And then we flew on in, and we got to on Iwo about 6 days after the invasion on the 19th of February, 45. Mm. And I was, we flew combat missions, strafing, we as a unit. We would launch the aircraft, and the way Iwo Jima was, we could run up on a hill adjacent to our operating areas and watch the fighters strafe the Japanese on the far end of the island. Then as they'd go back out to sea to come back and land, we'd go back down and resurface them and send them again.
Whoa, Ken, you really were in the thick of this war, weren't you?
Yes, we were.
Yeah.
And then our unit, on the 5th of April, 1945, we launched about 80 P-51s for the first strike over Tokyo, over Japan. Mm-hmm. And my unit commander, Jim Tapp, was the first fighter pilot over Tokyo. And fortunately, he shot down four Japanese that day.
Hmm. Remarkable. Do you remember what your thoughts were? You were such a young kid when you entered this war. What your thoughts were about Hitler during those years, what your thoughts were about what was going on in Europe, and how your thoughts evolved as you became a fighter in this, as America entered this war?
Well, the first thoughts I had, I knew we were at war. When the first airplane dropped his bombs and he banked away and we saw the rising sun on the side of the airplane, I grew up that day. Mm-hmm. As far as thinking about Europe, with no thoughts. Mm. Our self-preservation and what we were involved in, trying to survive. I've always thought that if the Japanese had came to Pearl, with the task force that they came to Midway, we'd have probably been eating lunch or dinner rice for supper. Because it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon before the infantry and artillery were able to organize themselves at Schofield Barracks, which was right next to our airfield, and move out into positions.
Oh, my. Have you ever been to Pearl Harbor before, Mark?
This is my first trip, and I just want to add, if I may, that Mr. Sweet's being actually underplaying his role, being the humble man that he is. You know, when he ran out to the parked vehicles, aircraft, he and his colleagues, to salvage them, I mean, they were battling dark smoke that was true. They were choking on it. And it's unbelievable how they were able to breathe. And you literally went into the wreckage and were pulling parts to reassemble aircraft, and you managed to get some airborne. Maybe you'd share that with Kathleen. That's a wonderful story.
Yes, there was 2 or 3 airplanes got off of the ground.
Really? At
Wheeler Field. But a group of the pilots hopped in a truck and drove 12 miles down to Haliva Airfield, where there was another unit having gunnery practice, and they had called down and told them to get airplanes ready. They're being attacked. This airfield had not been attacked. And the 7 or 8 pilots drove down and launched 4 or 5 aircraft. Ken Taylor and Welsh were 2 of them that I knew personally that shot down several Japanese that day.
Remarkable.
Ken Taylor ended up being the adjutant general of the state of Alaska.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
And the last time our unit got together in 1991 in Hawaii, he was able to be there.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, wonderful experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me, you didn't serve in World War II.
No, I didn't.
I don't think you've served in war. I know about it. No. Tell me about the view. What is there? What is at Pearl Harbor? And how you, as someone accompanying these wonderful, brave men, responded to all of this?
Well, it's a story of the human spirit. You know, it's a story that you can apply to civilian life as well as military life, regardless of what your challenges in life are. We really don't know how we're going to respond to a horrific event, whether it's a fire or a family loss or whatever. And what impresses me about these gentlemen is that it's an ongoing thing. I mean, you look back over 70 years ago, and how they responded to the immediate raid. I'm equally as impressed with how they are conducting their lives as role models now as senior members of society. When we followed Mr. Sweet and his colleagues, they were constantly reaching out to others. They were saluted by men and women of rank in active duty. There's this wonderful reverence for them, and they're handling this as a group of representatives of World War II Survivors Group. These gentlemen, I'm telling you, the way they handled themselves publicly on the island, they never told people to go away. They never said, I'm tired or I'm too busy. I mean, they are truly educators, and they have embraced this role with such grace and such seriousness and never drawing attention to themselves. They're always talking about the event. I mean, we have to pry the information out of you in terms of what you did as individuals to save one another. And because you take this role very seriously. And, Mr. Sweet, that is so impressive. That is just so impressive. I liken the experience to following the original seven Mercury astronauts. I mean, they have that same aura about it.
Thank you. One of the stories I very seldom tell, as we went on guard duty, we slept in the hangar, in the corner of one of the hangars. After the first bomb dropped, we headed for the hangar because I thought people were sleeping in the cots. Got into the hangar, and I ran into the corner where the cots were located, and everyone was out. And then I headed back through the hangar to get out. As I was going out the back door, there was a bomb came through the roof. I heard the crash, and I was like I was pushed out, pressure. Then I ran down the road, getting away from the hangars. The hangar that was next to ours hadn't been bombed yet, and as I was running, a gentleman that was running ahead of me got hit, and he fell. And I thought, if he got hit, I'm going to get hit. And there was a collapsible construction shack leaning against a tree in the parking lot right across the street. So I thought, I'll get on the opposite side of that. If the hangar got bombed, flying glass and everything, I'd be safe from it. And as I laid there, all of a sudden I heard strafing as the Japanese airplanes were coming flying overhead. And as I looked towards the west, I could see them bank around and make their run. Then I was really scared.
And those strafing marks on many of the buildings in the Pearl Harbor area remain today. If I can also add, what really touched Everett and I as we gathered these stories together was how you gentlemen individually have reconciled with the Japanese pilots. And you have done that on an individual basis.
Have you really? Oh, that's interesting. What have you done?
Well, I'll tell you, in 91 we had a reunion in Hawaii, and the people that organized it invited a Japanese pilot to come and share with us. And this Japanese pilot had shot down one of our pilots, and while he was in the parachute was strafing at him. Well, they had both of these people at the same table.
Oh, my.
And then they, after we ate in the program, they asked the Japanese pilot if he'd say a few words. And the first thing he said is, before I start, I want you to remember I was doing for my government what you were doing for your government. Mm-hmm. and all the animosity just left.
Mm. I thought it was an interesting part of the film, Mark, when you were speaking to a historian who said that there are about 1 million Japanese visitors to Pearl Harbor each year because the Japanese don't know about Pearl Harbor. I was astounded to hear that.
Because it's viewed as a defeat, Mr. Sweet, correct, yes. In Japanese culture.
Yeah.
The beginning of a defeat, yeah. Yeah.
The story I told in the summer of 41, they were organizing the Flying Tigers in China, General Chenault. And they were looking for mechanics and they're looking for pilots. So another fellow and I went on down to, wanted to go. One of the reasons was the monetary. We were being paid 70 cents a day at that time, and as I remember, the salary was going to be over 200. We went down to the Chinese consul to make applications, and I was 18. And they said, no way, you have to get your parents' permission. So I wrote home. And my
dear mom.
And my dear mother says, no way, you're too far from home now and you might get hurt.
You might
and
get hurt.
And then 3 months later, Pearl Harbor
came
up.
Little did she know, isn't that
I teased
something?
Her for the longest time about that.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. That was another, you asked some of the vets and they talked about forgiveness. Forgiveness had to have been a big part of this, of all the horrors of this war, of what the Japanese did, of what Hitler did to human beings. And to be able to forgive that kind of evil is a huge thing. It's a very big lesson for us to learn, don't you think?
Well, it is a big lesson, but as a military man, you and your colleagues, Mr. Sweet, had really respect for the skills of the pilot and for their execution and for the way they researched before they went on their raid.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that. I mean, to this day, respect them as skillful adversaries, right?
Yeah, the Japanese had good pilots, had great pilots, just like we did. Hmm. And as the pilot mentioned, he was doing his work like we were doing ours. Mm-hmm. Through the years, I met one of our commanders out in Yuma, Arizona. We were headed for San Diego. And he had flown out of Saipan into bombing on Iwo Jima before the invasion. And he looked at me and he says, I don't know what I'd have done if you were driving a Japanese car.
Wow.
Mm. Paul Fodick was his name. But I had no personal combat with the Japanese, so I didn't have a one-on-one hatred. A long time I had that feeling that... What would I do if I ran into a Japanese or met a Japanese?
Yes.
And I really don't know. I don't think I'd have... I think I'd have greeted them like a human being.
Yeah, I think you would have too, yeah. Mr. Sweet.
Several of Mr. Sweet's comrades who were serving aboard ship and manning the turrets at the time tell us that some of the planes came so close to their vessels that they actually saw their faces in the cockpit. And it was very much a one-to-one thing.
We're going to welcome phone calls. The documentary Return to Pearl will be shown. Mark, tell us, we've got to get to phone calls and pause for a moment, but you're having a preview tomorrow night, right?
At a wonderful place.
I'm sorry, let me get your mic here.
A wonderful place, Discovery World. And MPTV has an ongoing partnership premiering many of our projects through Discovery World. And yes, tomorrow night at 6:30. We are showing Return to Pearl, and we're going to have a little discussion afterwards. And many of your colleagues are going to be our honored guests there. So if viewers and listeners, we'd love to have them join us. They will also get the bonus offering of being able to meet some of these wonderful gentlemen and engage them personally.
Stars of the film.
Mm-hmm.
The stars of the film. And we also have information on our Facebook page that shows when the documentary will be on the air. So our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can also go to mptv.org. Return to Pearl will be shown on MPTV 10.1 and 36.2 Friday at 8, and again on 36.1 on Sunday at 10, and December 16th at 9 a.m. on 36.1. We welcome phone calls. Mark Segrist is joining us in our studio. Mark went on this trip, and he is the editor and the host and
well,
the
actually,
writer.
Mark Bernhardt is the editor, and he was another wonderful member of our team, and along with Chris and Dwayne, and of course our boss Everett. So it was
so
very,
you're the host,
very
you're
much
the...
a team effort. No, I'm right. just one player.
Oh, Mark.
Just one player. No,
Mark.
Seriously, this was a
okay.
wonderful collective effort.
Yeah. I understand. But Mark is there, and he's doing the interviews, and you'll see him in the documentary. Ken Sweet is also joining us. Ken sharing his reminiscence and obviously his experience at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, has stayed with him for a good chunk of his life. I want to find out more about the reunions and all of that as we continue. Plus, we want to take phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, we're talking about the Old Glory Honor Flight Return to Pearl, which took place June of 2012, and will be the subject of a documentary film on Milwaukee Public Television. A big event tomorrow night. I urge you to go to this. It will be one of those once-in-a-lifetime kinds of events. It's a free preview and a discussion featuring many of the vets who are honored and highlighted in this film, Return to Pearl. Mark Segrist, the documentary's host, is also joining us, and we have a ton of phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655. And let's go to Randy in Madison. Hi, Randy.
Good morning, and good morning, Mr. Sweet. Because of the nature of this this program, I've had the chance to talk to some real big shots before and some real big-name celebrities, but it's refreshing to be able to talk to somebody who's really important. And the if you indulge a little reminiscing, 31 years ago, I had just started working at my first daily newspaper, the Bismarck Tribune. And I got the job of talking to the local Pearl Harbor survivors. It was a real eye-opener for reasons that you've already discussed. And I've lost track, lost touch with most of them. I hope most of them are well. The real coup I had was to find one retired farmer who had been on the Arizona when it blew, and I hadn't realized there were any survivors that were actually on the Arizona. It turns out that there were a few dozen, and the that's just what I remember. And at the risk of being trivial, I'm wondering, Mr. Sweet, if you've seen any of the different movies, starting maybe back with From Here to Eternity, that recreated the attack.
Yes, I had. And thinking back, the one Toro, Toro, Toro was more accurate than the second one, Pearl Harbor. For the sake of the movie, they had actions from two or three airfields that were actually there into one airfield on the movie. But I thought it was fairly accurate.
Mm. And what about this journey? What was the highlight for you of this trip in June, Ken?
Well, my highlight was our meeting on the USS Missouri. We had a dinner on the board right on the spot where the surrender was signed.
Oh, yes.
And that was a highlight for myself. Seeing I had been back to Pearl, Hawaii several times since, but never on the Missouri, never really into the Pearl Harbor Navy part of Hawaii.
Hmm.
When I'd go back to Wheeler Field and visit the people I knew.
Mm-hmm. And there are lots of pictures. The documentary shows some of that dinner. That must have been an extraordinary experience to be on that particular ship.
Yeah, as you said, it's surrounded by different forms of media recalling and highlighting Douglas MacArthur and the Japanese leadership. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what a What a huge occasion that was. And again, it was an opportunity for you and your comrades to come full circle, sir.
Yes, full circle. It did. To realize that what we had gone through was ending. It ended at that spot. And that's just hard to explain.
When you and your colleagues came aboard that ship for that evening meal and tour, a rainbow came out, and we thought
I'd
forgotten that.
That was a very spiritual moment for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, you could read whatever you want to in that, but, you know, they were posing for a picture, and the rain stopped, and all of a sudden a rainbow comes out.
Yeah, it's on the film. It's on the documentary. It's one of those moments that you just look at and go, oh, wow.
Hawaiians call it liquid sunshine.
Very nice. Thank you, Randy, very much for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Kevin in Gays Mills. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. My radio was acting up, and I just tuned in at the time when he was talking about meeting a Japanese and not sure what he would do. And I was stationed in Pearl Harbor in the late 60s. In fact, I worked for 20th Century Fox when they filmed Tora, Tora, Tora. And a lot of the hangars were still broken out at that time from 1941. But I also drove the Arizona Shuttle Memorial boat. And it was hourly trips of, I don't know, 100 and some people, 100 people. It was a pretty good-sized boat. Every day, every trip, approximately three-quarters of the people on that boat were Japanese, and they would come to Arizona, and they would kneel, and they would cry, and they would pray. It was a very emotional experience.
Well, it was emotional for us, too, following Mr. Sweet and his colleagues. At the same time, the groups from Japan were also in Pearl Harbor. Many of them for the first time experiencing the history, the historical nature of the surroundings. And, you know, collectively, we kept reminded that this is not only an opportunity to come full circle for our American representatives of the military, but also for the Japanese people. And I don't know, it kind of puts things in perspective. It really does. I mean, did you have that similar... Because there were a great deal of Japanese tourists in the area at the same time that you gentlemen were retracing your footsteps.
Yeah, when we toured the Arizona Memorial, of course, we had a private showing. There wasn't many tourists. But then I realized on our flight out from Chicago, we had a Japanese tourist group flying with us.
Did you really?
Yes. When I first got aboard the airplane, I was sitting next to a Japanese pilot or person.
Uh-huh.
And I kept looking at him, and he'd look at me, and I thought, this is kind of ironic with this tour group, and yet that's the way Japan and America has so melted together and cooperated. But at first I thought, well, this is kind of odd. I wonder who arranged this.
Right, right. The years have gone by. Seth in Green Bay asks, he's a young historian, Mr. Sweet, and he wants to know what you feel is the best or most important thing we can do to keep the lessons of World War II in the forefront of our society.
Well, I've been talking to many people. Talk to school groups. During the war, I built up a photo album, historical book that I've lent to high school students that were doing studies on Pearl Harbor.
Oh.
And about eight or nine through the years, I've utilized my scrapbooks.
Hmm.
People know I was a Pearl Harbor survivors, and I will not hesitate to talk about it and how prepared we must be today as compared to what we were in 1940.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the other thing that we learned is what you just said, and you can think about this in many ways, that you were sitting next to a Japanese person who was going to Pearl Harbor as well, and you're thinking, Well, wish that could have happened before this huge war started, right? I mean, there's something profound about just that experience, I think. There really is. The gentlemen who were on this wonderful journey, Mark, did they know each other? Had they known each other in Pearl Harbor or not?
No, there were just two of us that knew each other.
Really?
Or three, I'm sorry. There's four Pearl Harbor survivors that I'm aware of in the city of Milwaukee. One of them was, after Pearl Harbor, wanted to be a pilot. So he applied. They sent him back to the United States. He flunked out of flying school, became a bombardier. On his 10th mission over Europe in a B-17, he was shot down, spent 14 months in a POW, and was rescued by the Russians up in the Baltic area where he was. He says he did not go on this flight. He says it's too long a ride for an old man.
And this is a 90-year-old veteran saying this here. Just to add to this, if I may, what really impressed me about your group is that even though many of you did not know one another before you went on this flight and this trip, is that, and yet the fact that you're all Pearl Harbor survivors, whenever you get together, you guys have your own humor. You're not above ribbing one another about your age or whatever illnesses you might be facing. I mean, you still bring it to one another pretty harshly when you want to in a humorous form. Yeah. And also, you just kind of communicate with one another with a look like, oh, you were at Wheeler, huh? Mm-hmm. Oh, you were at Schofield Barracks, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And it's not a whole lot said, but there's that look. Yeah. And what also is interesting is that you guys were great in terms of, you know, opening your hearts and sharing your stories with us as journalists. But whenever we would step back and we would eavesdrop on conversations between maybe two or three of you, the reality really came out. I mean, you guys don't hold back at all when you're together.
Yeah.
You know, it's just because you all went through it.
You were all there. And there must be something different. I know you've been there several times. But to have a group of you who were all there on December 7, 1941, returning 71 years later, that has to be a very unique experience. It's different than going with your family.
Well, one of the gentlemen that went with us, he and I rode the same boat in 1940 to Hawaii. After basic training, we ended up in the same squadron throughout the whole war. He lives out in Brookfield now, and we still keep in contact about once a month for breakfast.
Is that Mr. McClavick you're referring to? Ed McClavick?
Ed McClavick.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Let's go back to phone calls. Thanks, Kevin, for your call. We have a couple lines open. They've been filled. 800-486-8655. Joe in North Prairie. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Mr. Sweet for his... what he contributed to the greatest generation. I'm a recently retired history teacher, and a few years back we had the Marine Band here in North Prairie to recognize those veterans from World War II. And one of those gentlemen, Marcel Breaux, was on a Marine on Pearl Harbor, as well as a survivor from a medic from Omaha Beach, and a couple other ones from Iwo Jima, from Waukesha. But you know, it's interesting when you talk to these veterans in World War II, and the Marines from the band came up and saluted them and thanked them, and they all say, I didn't do anything special. Mm-hmm. And yet, as the Marines pointed out to them, if it hadn't been for your generation, we wouldn't be here today. And that's a remarkable thing of that whole generation, and we're losing those individuals at 1,000 a day, and it's just incredible their humbleness and their willingness to share with the generations now of what they went through and what they extended, because we literally plucked them off the streets and out of the farm, were thrown into the most horrendous situations that they could ever imagine in their life. And again, thank you, Mr. Sweet, for your contributions, and thank you for being able to open and speak about this, because I know a lot of individuals from that generation really can't do that. My friend, who is now 96, who was the medic on Omaha Beach, he won't talk about it at all, and I can understand why. In fact, when he went to watch a movie Saving Private Ryan, he didn't speak for 3 days afterwards because he relived that situation.
That's a tough movie. Have you always been able to talk about your experience or not?
No, I have not been. Matter of fact, with the interview for the papers and what we saw in the movie preview up at Oshkosh, my family was hearing stories for the first time.
Really? Why was it hard? And it was hard for many vets, I know. Why? Why hard to talk, Ken?
I just didn't want to share. I didn't want to bring out the memories and the sounds and the smells and the fears that you had. I just kept it inside. Not that it was boiling inside of me, but I just didn't want to share.
Mm-hmm. But I guess you reach a point in your life, Mark, because these vets were willing to share, and if you have skilled people asking questions, it's time for them to speak, and they are.
Right, and the fact that they went back to Pearl Harbor together as a group, was very special for you as a group. I mean, that's my perspective, just viewing it from afar, and allowed you to open up as a group, didn't it?
Well, we grew up in the days with no TV and no electronics like we have today, and it was just getting to know each other and fellowshipping one another that we grew up in that era. Today, I don't think that people would have the same association that we grew up in. I can remember living on a farm without electricity in the outhouse. That contributed to my background.
More phone calls if you'd like to join us in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Return to Pearl will be shown a free preview and discussion open to the public tomorrow at Discovery World in Milwaukee. If you haven't been there, it's, as Mark said, it's a beautiful place. And some of the veterans who returned to Pearl Harbor in June of this year will be part of a panel discussion. It should be just a very moving and important night. Doors open at 6 o'clock tomorrow night, seating on a first-come basis. If you'd like to watch the show in the comfort of your own home or friend's home, Return to Pearl will be shown on Milwaukee Public Television on Friday at 8 o'clock and on Sunday at 10 o'clock. And that's on Channel 10, right, on Sunday. And then on Channel 36...
And, of course, a good way to be familiar with the time and the specific channels within the MPTV family is just to go to our website, which is pretty simple, www.mptv.org, and they will update our viewers with the next showing available.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Sweet has pulled out some interesting photographs. What is this, sir?
Wait, can you hold off?
I'm sorry.
Hold on one moment, and we'll go to the photographs, okay? And if you don't mind, we'd like to take a picture of you to put on our Facebook page, too, because people would like to see you and Mark, but particularly Mr. Sweet.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, Mark. We'll do that after the show is over. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to an email from Adam in Milwaukee. Mr. Sweet, we have awareness of post-traumatic stress disorder. Back in your era, there was no name for it, but do your fellow soldiers exhibit any symptoms of PTSD?
I do not recall personally having it, and I've always been amazed at what we hear about that today among the troops coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. We just came home. Matter of fact, I was separated from service in 45 at Fort Sheridan, rode the local transport up to Milwaukee, knocked on the door to get into my home. So there was no greetings as we have read about from time to time.
But surely some of those images, because there are things that happen to all of us in our lives, and much more so to a soldier, images that you would rather you not have in your mind, and they're still there.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know how to respond to that.
Right. Okay. Let's go to Vic in Milwaukee. Hello, Vic.
Hi. Yes.
Hello, Mr. Sweet. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, very well.
Yes. I want to thank you first. I think what your generation did, not only for America, but the rest of the world, was great, and it ushered us into a new era worldwide. I'm a naturalized citizen, and I'm very proud of your generation and what they have done, not only for the United States, but for the whole world. My question today is, based on how America and the United States dealt with Japan and Germany, let's say the evil empire and their goals and the evil Nazi Germany, what are the lessons, you know, and how we have taken those countries and made them into mainstream today? How can we use some of those lessons for, let's say, the Arab world, where the terrorism has become an evil and it's only, let's say, 10% or less of their population? How can we use some of the lessons from that time today? What would be your advice to us?
Well, I'm sorry. I really wouldn't know how to approach that subject.
What about the subject of, because you have thoughts about this, and we listen to you more than we would listen to other people who haven't been in war. The whole idea of we always think it's the end. We always think that you've lived through the end of war. There could be no more war because of the horrors of this. And you've obviously thought about this some. Why do we keep having them?
I'm not sure. We're living in a different world, a different climate, a different attitude of everyone. I think because of the era we grew up in, we accepted everything as it was presented. Today, everybody is questioning everybody mm-hmm. else. It's a negative world today, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
You spend a lot of time, Mark, with these 19 people. I imagine you'll stay in touch with many of them.
Oh, they're my role models now for manhood.
I'll bet.
You see very little bravado coming from them, and a lot of compassion and will to live,
mm-hmm.
A spirit that just doesn't even think about giving up, no matter what kind of challenges you face in life. These gentlemen are now my new role models.
Mm-hmm.
I think they define what the equipment that one needs to carry through life in order to face life on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little, we're running out of time, I could sit here all day, about Old Glory Honor Flight and making this journey to Pearl Harbor. They go to Washington too, don't they?
A wonderful organization. It's one of six chapters. We have a fine chapter here in Milwaukee and throughout various locations in the state. Old Glory Honor Flight is an Appleton chapter of the Honor Flight organizations here throughout the state, and they all are making wonderful trips to Washington, D.C. on a regular basis. And this, Drew McDonald and Diane McDonald, his wife, and other leadership from Old Glory put together this Pearl Harbor experience now because they felt that this generation needed to be recognized first, and the goal is to, in coming years, it's my understanding that they will be offering similar opportunities as they are in flights to Washington, D.C., for all who have served so that they can experience the tributes yeah. and the recognition.
Mm-hmm.
When World War II Memorial was dedicated, there was a doctor down in Ohio attended the dedication, and he formed the organization to bring World War II vets back to Washington. He put a blurb in the USA Today, which I saw, and I gave him a call.
Oh.
And he sent me paperwork for 10 people, World War II veterans, I was aware of. And we flew into Washington. They flew into Baltimore, and we were there for 3 days.
Oh.
We stayed in Baltimore, and then we had two busloads of World War II veterans in that group being bused into Washington. And as we gathered the first night, there was a feeling that we knew everybody because we knew we experienced something along the same lines if we were out in the Pacific or were in Europe. And it was, we just blend together. And We told the same World War II stories over and over.
Keep telling them, please. Thank you both so much for being with us. All the best with the film and all the best with your life. Thank you so much for being with us. We did, Brett just came in and took some pictures. So through the wonders of modern technology, Ken Sweet will now be on our Facebook page and Mark Willa as well. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Get a whole listing of all of the times of the film at mptv.org. And please attend that evening tomorrow. It should be just wonderful. It's at Discovery World Innovation Theater on Harbor Drive in Milwaukee. Return to Pearl will be shown at that time. Street parking at no cost and doors open at 6 o'clock. And some of the stars of the film, the vets, will be there. Thank you both. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produce this program. Until tomorrow.